Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well, Robert. How are you?
Doing pretty good. Let's see. This week we have, as always, a COVID-19 update where we are going through all of the things that the Kentucky government has done in response to the coronavirus and its diseases outbreak. Jasmine's going to bring that to us this week. I have several other segments. I'm going to talk to us about the end of the legislative session, which happened just a few hours after we finished recording last week. So this news may be a little old to you, but it's new to the show, so we have plenty to talk about, including some abortion bills that passed at the last second, school board members, and then we have some quick hits. So without any further ado, Jasmine, what do we need to know about COVID-19?
As of yesterday's press conference, Kentucky has over 3,000 cases now. We had just hit 2,000 about the time we recorded last week. So we have over 1,000 new cases since last week. I don't know the numbers for today. I don't think Bashir has said them yet because we're recording during his press conference. But I think some of the big news since we last recorded, Kentucky has now joined a Midwestern partnership with Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. So I guess that answers the question of whether we're a Midwestern state or a Southern state.
Yeah, what do you think? I'm still a little skeptical about us being joining the Midwest. This would be a joining the Midwest type situation, I think. And I'm a little bit more able to be persuaded there that we've joined the Midwest and left the South rather than we were always a part of it. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad move on our part.
Yeah, I'm happy to be with the Midwest, at least in the sense of dealing with this pandemic, because our southern states like Tennessee and Georgia seem to be the ones that are doing poorly. So I'd rather be grouped in with the Midwestern states.
Yeah, here. Yeah, absolutely. I think that the Midwest certainly is doing a much better job. I do think that Kentucky needed to join the Midwest because, you know, a lot of the Midwestern states are doing really well, but they wanted Indiana to come with. And in order to get Indiana fully boxed in, they had to get Kentucky. So, you know, we have Ohio on one side, Michigan on top, and Illinois on, you know, to the west. And in order to get Indiana, we had to box them in with Kentucky so they couldn't be like a big hole in the middle. So I think this is as beneficial for Indianans, Hoosiers, as it is for Kentuckians.
Yeah, definitely. So what this partnership looks like, Governor Bashir is going to be working with the governors of these Midwestern states to come up with a plan for reopening the economy in phases based on hitting certain metrics. So Indiana and Ohio both announced goals of reopening some businesses by May 1st, which is in about a week. So that's pretty soon. I don't think Kentucky is there yet. I don't know if those states are really there yet either. But the benchmarks that are part of their criteria are the number and rate of new cases. Bashir has said in his press conferences over the last week that we have to see a decrease of, I think, 14 days in a row of decreases in cases, increased testing capacity, more personal protective equipment, the ability to protect at-risk populations, ability to social distance, preparedness to deal with a possible spike, and status of vaccine and treatment. So those are the things that they're going to be looking at in making reopening decisions.
Yeah.
Also, since last week, both UK and U of L have announced different kinds of cuts that they'll be making. And U of L announced furloughs that are going to be made due to the virus. And the Louisville Metro government has already furloughed 380 city employees. Big hits to like public jobs are starting to happen right now. Bashir also announced that schools would remain closed for the rest of the year, which I think we all expected. We were just waiting to hear it officially. And I believe JCPS got approved for the last day of NTI to be May 27th. And I think right now, kind of the question is how different schools are going to deal with making things like graduations happen. And Bashir said he would be good with a plan for some kind of drive-up graduation ceremony. I think Bullitt County is trying to have graduation in October. So I think school districts are trying to figure out a way to honor the seniors who will be graduating this year. Also, since we recorded last week, as we were recording, we saw the first protest at the Capitol. So we were able to briefly mention it as we were recording last week. So after seeing a couple days of protests, I think the next day they did like a drive-by protest with signs and things like that. After that, we've now seen death threats directed towards the governor on social media.
Yeah, some scary stuff for sure.
Yeah, so several Facebook posts that were kind of shared around basically said that Bashir needed to be taken out via the Second Amendment. And I don't actually know that this is where they started, but I think the first place that I really saw this happening being shared was from the Boone County Neighborhood Group.
That was definitely the one that got the most attention on social media.
Yeah, so as of today, someone in Louisville has even been charged. So James Troutman, he's an attorney in Louisville. I think on Facebook his name was Greg Troutman. He's been charged with terroristic threatening in the third degree for comments that were made on Facebook. He said, maybe some should ask Bashir in a press conference about his thoughts on William Goebel. For those of you who don't know the history, it's a good read. So William Goebel was the 34th governor of Kentucky. And I think we talked about this on the podcast a couple months ago, but he was shot the day before he was sworn in and died 4 days later.
Yeah, he was the only person that had their election, you know, had to be recounted. That's why we talked about it, just during the recount.
Yes. Yes. And so Troutman also said in an exchange with somebody else, someone asked about Bashir shooting license plates. And Troutman said, with any luck, the governor will be the one at whom the shooting will be directed. And I learned today after he'd been charged, he's actually been suspended from the bar before for shooting an arrow into a neighbor's house. And it looks like he may have pled guilty to charges in that case. And then he's gotten in trouble since then for practicing law during his suspension and picking up some like fleeing and evading police charges several years ago as well. So someone has been charged for threatening the governor. Just looking on its face, I'm not sure if those actions would meet the elements of terroristic threatening in the third degree, but he got arrested and I think he was posting bond today. So threats against the governor, not good. You can get charged criminally for that.
I think the governor would say can't be doing that. Or maybe not him, but we will say you can't be doing that.
Yeah. And since this kind of started over the weekend, a lot of GOP legislators and their constitutional officers denounced the threats. But as far as I know, Savannah Maddox, who had been a leader in the protests, has been silent.
Yeah. That's not too surprising to me, but it is disappointing.
Yeah. In lawsuit news, Maryville Baptist Church, that's the church that had Easter services that we talked about last week in Bullitt County. They have sued Governor Bashir for violations of the First Amendment and Kentucky's version of RFRA, the Religious and Freedom Restoration Act. And we already have a ruling on their motion for a temporary restraining order. So a federal judge, Judge David Hale, denied their motion. They are arguing, you know, that the governor is targeting religion by not allowing them to have faith-based services. But Judge Hale said that Bashir's order to prevent the spread of COVID-19 bans all mass gatherings, any event or convening that brings together groups of individuals, including civic, public, leisure, faith-based, or sporting events, as well as concerts, festivals, and conventions. So this is kind of what I was talking about when we talked about this on the podcast, that the problem is that Mayor Fisher's statement, whether it was an order or not, is still up for question, but it seemed to be targeting religion. And if you have a neutral rule, such as banning all mass gatherings, I think that makes it a little different and there's a lower standard. Mm-hmm. And so Maryville Baptist Church's request for a temporary restraining order, basically to block his ordered banning gatherings, has been denied. So different ruling from a different federal judge in Kentucky.
Yeah, and I, based on what you were telling us whenever you were talking about this a couple weeks ago, it makes sense because the governor's order certainly just said, like, it includes church gatherings in addition to all mass gatherings, and the mayor's is a lot more unclear. So it would seem to me, not a lawyer, that would make more sense. So, like, the governor's order seems like it has more of a chance than the mayor's statements.
The mayor still could prevail if it's not an actual order. And I think that's the big question in the case with Mayor Fisher. But that case is with a different judge.
Right. Yeah,
Judge Justin Walker,
the big
who's
problem
auditioning
is,
for the Supreme Court.
I think the mayor's biggest problem is the judge he's in front of rather than anything else. Yeah.
That's just a ruling on the temporary restraining order. We don't have a ruling on the merits in that case either. But that's where we are with lawsuit news. And then last but not least, just some new news today that's happened in the last 30 minutes. You can now submit a reopening proposal to healthyatwork.ky.gov. And this is pretty big news. New test drive-up sites will be opening in Louisville and Lexington next week that will be open testing sites. So anyone who wants a test can presumably go get one regardless of being symptomatic or not.
Yeah.
So I think this is a pretty big breakthrough in testing. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we continue to get more testing. But yeah, that's the new news so far for today. Governor Beshear is still talking, but those are the two big things.
Yes, and Jasmine, as you've been talking through all of this, I have been refreshing the Twitter and have a little bit more to say just on the point of the additional testing. It does look like the two sites in Louisville and Lexington will have a capacity of 1,500 tests for two straight weeks. And I think that they've clarified that their goal, in order to get to the place where things can start to reopen, in addition to all the other criteria, the testing goal that they have, I think, is 21,000 tests per week. So ways to go. A lot of tests are able to be done. It's nice to have this additional 1,500 per week in these sites in Louisville and Lexington, but that seems to be the big additions since you've started talking. So there you go. All right.
Yeah, so that's the COVID-19 update.
Another a couple of weeks of social distancing podcasting for sure. So, yes, that is the COVID-19 update. Let me talk a little bit about the end of the legislative session. Two stories about this from stuff that happened at the end of last week. So the Kentucky General Assembly came to a close last Wednesday. And again, that was just a few hours after we recorded the podcast. It was a really strange COVID-19 shortened session and significantly fewer bills passed than other sessions. I ran the numbers and about 200 bills had passed in both short and long sessions in the past 3 years, so from 2017 through 2019. This year, only 136 bills passed. So the last 2 days of the session were on the calendar for veto overrides. You know, these were inevitable. The legislature is controlled by Republicans and the governor is a Democrat, so you're going to have some stuff that gets vetoed. The legislature, just to try to be as down the line as we can be here, the legislature really did heed Governor Beshear's advice to avoid passing too many controversial laws this session. They didn't pass HB1, which is, of course, the cuts to the social safety net, and they also didn't pass SB1, which is the Sanctuary Cities Bill, bills that we've highlighted significantly throughout this entire session. But they did pass several bills which were never going to get signed by the governor. And we talked about a lot of those last week, and they included SB2, some stuff that was really, really bad, but they left some other stuff that was pretty bad on the table. So the last 2 days of the legislative session, while they were there for veto overrides, that they're not restricted to veto overrides. The legislature can basically do anything that they want to during those 2 days. And so in addition to the veto overrides, which, again, we discussed last week, they passed a sweeping anti-abortion measure that had been kind of stalled in the legislature. And the bill that passed is the Born Alive bill, if you've heard of that. And that's been passed in many states across the country. And in Kentucky, it was this year's Senate Bill 9, sponsored by Whitney Westerfield. So Jasmine, it's really hard to put into words like how cynical these Born Alive bills like actually are. If you're unfamiliar with the conceit put forth by the GOP, the idea is that like some abortions result accidentally in a child being born alive, and this bill mandates that such children be given rights. And it's based on some like weird reporting from like this very bad doctor. But like if you talk to any physician, you'll learn that like the way that this bill works, it's very dangerous because the term alive is a much more squishy concept than you might expect. You know, we have terms like brain dead or vegetative state. And Jasmine, I know you know this, but there's like significant case law around what constitutes incapacitated for mm-hmm. people. Yeah. So this bill, though, is very explicit as to what being alive means, saying that an infant is considered alive if it can breathe, have a heartbeat, if its umbilical cord pulsates, or if it has voluntary movement of muscles.
I have a question there.
Yeah.
Can it be just any of those or all of those? Because any. The language seems to be or. So if there's even just one of those, that
absolutely. Any of those
means alive.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know, on a personal level, this bill, you know, would have made the abortion that our family had last year a legal gray area. You know, that was like the worst thing that ever happened to me, the worst thing that ever happened to my family. It would have just made like that situation significantly worse. And you know, mm-hmm. this was the bill that really started in Virginia a major abortion controversy and really led to some serious issues for that governor. And I really think that one of the main reasons that these kind of bills pass are not because they want to help anybody, because this bill doesn't help anybody. It's to, you know, push forward on this issue and make people feel uncomfortable in a way that they have to vote for something that they know is wrong, but because of the misunderstanding of the issue of abortion and what it means, and especially for abortions that include situations like this, like our situation, they just push forward with these kinds of things in order to win political fights, which is just really cynical and disappointing. So that's what they spent their last 2 days doing. So in addition to the Born Alive bill, the legislature also added a section to SB 9. So SB 9 was the Born Alive bill, and they added a new section allowing the state's attorney general to stop abortions during the state of emergency. This is something that many other southern states have done. Texas and Arkansas, I think, are examples of states that have done this. Andy Beshear has allowed abortions to continue during the state of emergency as, you know, healthcare, and this is definitely something that's like time is of the essence. So it makes sense to me that abortion be able to be allowed to continue. But this bill does take the authority out of the governor's hands and put it into the attorney general's hands. There's no way to put forward this bill except for to say that it was like completely unnecessary, because Andy Beshear, who won his race as a pro-choice person, is almost certainly going to veto it. It's really difficult to say what the point of any of this was, except for to signal to conservatives that they care really more about abortion than the coronavirus. I think at the end of the day, that's our main takeaway. So
do you think he'll certainly veto it?
Oh yeah, definitely. I don't think that there's any chance he lets this stand.
I think it's tough because the Born Alive part of it is it is what it is, but then you have this section that they added on about allowing the attorney general to stop abortions during a state of emergency. And I think if that was a bill on its own, he would 100% veto it, but they've tacked it on to this like morality issue that you're supposed to feel bad, you know, if you veto this part of it. So
yeah, he's vetoed.
It's very sticky and political.
Yeah, he's vetoed all the other abortion legislation, and the fact that he can veto this without them being able to override it, and the fact that, you know, he's already won an election as a pro-choice governor in Kentucky, I think it's absolutely the case that he's going to veto this. Like, he has a lot of people that are counting on him. The Planned Parenthood and NARAL both like did a lot to support his election. So I think it's almost it's absolutely certain in my mind that he's going to veto them. So, and even Whitney Westerfield on the floor of the Senate said the governor is going to veto this. So I don't know. It hasn't happened yet. I checked on Wednesday. So if it doesn't, we'll update you. But Jasmine, that was not the only drama there towards the end of the legislative session. In addition, the school board members got confirmed, all except for one. So one of Andy Beshear's consistent campaign promises was to remake Kentucky's Board of Education. And of course, he did that almost immediately. We talked about this when it happened. It sets up a showdown with the Kentucky State Senate. The Kentucky State Senate has the authority to confirm the governor's appointments to the Board of Education. And it was always unclear to me what the Senate was going to do. It was really one of the most dramatic things going into the session, whether they would let the governor's appointment stand or not and have an all-new Board of Education again next year. And on the last day of the session, Senate President Robert Stivers did allow for confirmation votes to be held on all of the members of the Board of Education. And 10 out of those 11 Board of Education members were confirmed, with lots and lots of Republicans voting yes. However, the chairman of the Board of Education, David Karam, he was not confirmed. Seven senators who had voted yes on all of the other nominees switched their position on Karam's nominee to no. Senate President Stivers was really not thrilled about taking these votes in the first place. That's something we've detailed since the beginning of the session. His quote, though, for this week was to say, quote, "Because the governor says we need consistency at this point in time, this is not the time or place to take these individuals out. I'm going to support so that there can be consistency at this time," unquote. He also asked that no other boards be reorganized, especially during the pandemic. And, even though the Senate did kind of like get their pound of flesh by preventing David Karam from being nominated, Governor Beshear was very thankful to Stivers for allowing his nominees to continue. This was a big fight, and Stivers really did not have to do this. I mean, on one level, I think it's very nice of him to have done this and the prudent and smart decision. And it is certainly disappointing to the governor's supporters that David Karam, who's like one of the best educational minds and is very good about this issue, it's very disappointing that he's not going to get confirmed. But, the Senate didn't need to, and it's hard to imagine them just totally rolling over for this issue. So they had to do something, I think, and because so many members of the Republican caucus were upset about this, this is, I think, what they landed on doing. So the governor now has to nominate a new board member, and one of the big issues was that nobody on the board was Republican, even though the governor is not supposed to consider that when making decisions about who to nominate. I think it's highly likely that the next nominee will be a Republican. We will see. That's definitely something we are going to see in the next little bit here. So, I mean, are you surprised that the Senate did this, Jasmine?
Not really, because it seems like our legislature can't just do anything completely nice, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there something specific about David Karam for like being the reason that he was the one not confirmed? Is it just because he was the chair?
I think it's a couple of things. I think that's probably first and foremost is that he was the chair. One of the other things is that he was one of the chief authors of CARA. And Stivers said that like CARA is bad, which I was kind of surprised to see. So I think that he was maybe a more partisan member of the legislature. He has served in the legislature before, and so maybe that was something there. I know that he was in the House, and this was, of course, a Senate thing, but several of the senators, especially on the Republican side, I do believe have served time in the Kentucky House, so that might be one of the issues as well.
Yeah, I guess I couldn't have predicted exactly what would happen, like they would confirm them all but one, but I definitely could have predicted some kind of funny business with the confirmation.
Yeah, that was probably a safe bet. No guests today. We had a late cancellation, but we do have some quick hits before we get out of here. Jasmine, unemployment insurance has been a major backstop of this crisis. Millions of people across the country have had to stay home and business has mostly idled. And people are really depending on UI more than ever before. If you've seen the charts, they're unbelievable. I mean, you have like 12 times the weekly claims that you've ever had before. And really, this has caused a lot of UI systems, which are administered on the state level, to fail. And in Kentucky, there has been some real trouble. At the beginning of the crisis, the state only had the ability to take 1,000 calls per day, which was more than enough before. The state's now receiving about 25,000 calls per day. But the wait time after the state went ahead and hired 1,000 new people is down to what they say at 6 minutes, which isn't so bad. And even though there's like significant issues with administering this problem, this program, and a couple of the people I know that are on unemployment are like, I may have to leave this conversation and take this phone call because the unemployment people may call me and this may be my only chance this week. And, you know, that's not great. But I do think that Kentucky's efforts are really to be commended. This has been a really difficult situation. And I think the public servants, leaders, and followers, people who do the work, really need to be congratulated and commended for all their work in this very difficult situation.
Yeah, I have still been hearing stories as of yesterday of people having hours and hours long wait time. So I don't know how accurate that 6 minutes is, but hopefully it's getting better.
Yeah, I think that that's a self-reported number, and I think it's like an average of 6 minutes. And obviously there's going to be some people who they pick up the phone for immediately and don't have any wait at all. And I'm not surprised to hear that there's people with hours and hours of wait time as well. So yeah, it's hard to say. But this is literally an impossible situation. You know, my degree being in public administration and not working in public administration, I'm always just kind of like, yeah, you know, I think that there's a better way to do that. Or like, I really think that, you know, if I was in charge, I know how I would do this differently. This situation, I'm like, this is a disaster. I'm amazed that anyone is getting through at all. Yeah. And of course, I think the governor's done a really good job of saying, you know, if you're in the group of people that isn't getting through, this is no comfort to you. And that's exactly right. But I think it's worth it to say, you know, they're doing a pretty good job, even though a lot of people are definitely going to be frustrated. Okay, the last one is a little weird. Since the end of the legislative session, two Republican legislators from Laurel County have been arrested. Derek Lewis, who is from Laurel County, he was arrested on a DUI the day after the session ended. His truck was found in a ditch, and that was pretty bad. But then about a week later, we heard that Robert Goforth, he serves in Laurel County as well, he was arrested for domestic violence issue. Very, very serious stuff. Separate from the domestic violence issues that came up during his gubernatorial campaign as well. This is something different if you remember that. Jasmine, I know you're a defense attorney, so you will say, like, arrests do not imply guilt, and there's a whole process that we go through, and everybody's innocent until proven guilty, but definitely worth highlighting that these guys seem to have some pretty significant charges coming their way.
Yeah, and these aren't just, I don't know, like, petty charges. They're both kind of serious.
Yeah.
And the Robert Goforth charge, he's actually charged with strangulation, which we did not have a specific felony for strangulation until 2019. Usually, at least in Jefferson County, it kind of fell under wanton endangerment in the first degree, which is a Class D felony. But last year in 2019, the legislature passed a bill to create a strangulation statute. And it's actually a Class C felony, which is 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
So he's charged with a pretty serious offense. But yes, you're right, Robert. Allegedly.
Right. Allegedly. they did say that, you know, the complainant, the person, the woman who he's is his alleged victim, had some pretty significant physical evidence that was found, you know, on her body, which is tough to hear and tough to read about and very disappointing. But yeah, we will see what happens there for sure.
And Robert Goforth did vote for the strangulation bill. Another interesting piece.
Hoisted by your own petard, I think is what that's called. All right, Jasmine. Well, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter and Instagram at MLKYPod. They can like our Facebook page and listen to our podcast on the podcast app of their choice. We also have a newsletter that comes out on Fridays. We partner with Ford Kentucky to do that. You can subscribe to it at fordky.com/email. And we have a Patreon page. You can support this podcast that we do for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast. And last but not least, we're part of the Demcast Network.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.